We wrapped up another busy week on Friday, July 10th, right here on Connecticut Today. Author Julie Kelly stopped by in the 3 o'clock hour. She's written a new book about Republicans who still can't stand President Trump. You, of course, know them as the Never Trumpers. And in the 4 o'clock hour, we had excerpts of a news conference at the Capitol earlier in the day from leaders on both sides of the aisle putting together a draft bill for police reform in Connecticut. One of the folks we heard from, Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Steve Stafstrom. His guest is a former political consultant in suburban Chicago. Oh, nothing better than Chicago politics. She's a senior contributor to American Greatness. She's also can be read and has written in the past for the National Review, The Federalist, The Hill, and The Wall Street Journal. Not too shabby. The name of the new book is Disloyal Opposition, How the Never Trump Right Tried and Failed to Take Down the President. Julie Kelly is the guest. Hi, Julie. Paul here on WICC. How are you?
I'm good, Paul. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Boy, I tell you, I have some friends of mine who've done some political work in and about Chicago. When I read you were a consultant in suburban Chicago, I said, boy, there's a resume filler right there.
Well, I have to say, Paul, it was years ago, but I worked for a long time for various Republicans when we had Republicans here in Illinois, in suburban Chicago. Yeah. But yes, it's a great town. It's the town's number one sport, politics.
Yeah, no, nobody does politics like Chicago. Your book is interesting, Julie. You know, when I and you probably and a lot of folks around the country about 4 years ago said, you know what, geez, I think Trump's got a shot here amongst all these Republicans. You could see some of the career Republicans start to get really antsy and this look of fear that came over them. And one in particular I know that you've had a relationship with and I used to see all the time and read all the time was Bill Kristol. And he has kind of elevated himself, has he not, Julie, as the leader of the Never Trumpers here?
He definitely is the head of the Never Trump movement. Bill Kristol, as for your listeners, I'm sure most of them know, was the founder and longtime editor of the Weekly Standard, which was a conservative publication, very influential in the George W. Bush administration. They were boosters of the Iraq War and all of the intervention, kind of the Bush doctrine years. But he was opposed to Donald Trump from the start. So really for the past 5 years, since Trump announced his candidacy, Bill Kristol and other kind of outlier conservatives and Republicans have done everything in their power to try to first derail his candidacy and then really destroy his presidency. But Paul, the book is not just about how they've gone after the president. They've gone after Republicans. They've gone after the Republican Party, the rank-and-file Republicans. And so it really details how they are disloyal to all of us who at one time supported them.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I'm wondering, Julie, and you having worked for Bill, too, in the past, I'm wondering, did it come to a point where many of the Republican, the old guard, the stalwarts, you know, the people that you and I used to see and hear all the time among the Republicans, I wonder if it became a case of them not understanding what was going on in the country, not being so tone deaf as to not taking that deep breath and looking back maybe around and saying, geez, maybe I'm missing something here. Did they not do that?
Well, first I want to clarify, I didn't work for Bill Kristol, but I was a longtime fan of his. So that's kind of what I start off in the book. I just want to clarify, he was really one of my political mentors, I would say, just watching him and reading him and subscribing to his magazine. But I think two things happened. At first, there was a legitimate concern that Trump would not govern as a conservative. You know, being a Manhattan businessman and friendly with the Clintons and Democrats. So I think at first it was legitimate. But after that, they saw the threat that Donald Trump posed to their power and influence within the Republican Party. And what was really interesting, Paul, as I detail in my book, once the Access Hollywood tape came out and a lot of Republicans abandoned Donald Trump, some of them had to come back out and say they supported him again because the rank and file saw the dirty tricks operation that was moving against Donald Trump. And they were going to choose him over rank-and-file Republicans, incumbent senators, all of the party leaders who thought that they had all this influence over the Republican Party. And they saw that immediately they came to Trump's defense. And so these leaders had to come back out and say that they supported him. And so I think that was a tipping point. And since then, it's kind of been this intra-party battle. But as you know, Paul, 90% of Republicans support Donald Trump. So this little group that pretends and gives this false impression that they represent a big swath of Republicans and conservatives who oppose Donald Trump, it's just an illusion. It's and they're funded by the left to create this illusion on CNN and MSNBC and all the places where they're paid.
Julie Kelly is the guest and author of the book Disloyal Opposition, How the Never Trump Right Tried and Failed to Take Down the President. Julie, please hang on. We'll be right back with you. Got to do a little business here more with author and writer Julie Kelly. Straight ahead first, so let's check traffic. 336 on WICC. Author and former political consultant in suburban Chicago, Julie Kelly is the guest. The name of the book is Disloyal Opposition, How the Never Trumper Right Tried and Failed to Take Down the President. You know, Julie, before we took the break, you mentioned some of the operations that are underway as we get toward the 2016 election. And I have very well-intentioned but slightly to the left friends of mine. Bombarding me with these. No, I love them.
Bad
I really
idea,
do.
Paul.
They're good friends of mine. But no, because the stuff they send me makes me giggle. It makes me laugh. And oh, they're all agog, Julie, over the Lincoln Project. Oh, this is gonna. And I tell them with all tact. I said, you know, this is like. This is a crumb of the Republic, you know, crumbs of the GOP. I said, exactly what you said, Julie. You know that, like, for all his faults or whatever you think of him, I said, like, 90% of the Republican Party supports him. And the, you know, the Lincoln, first of all, for our people who don't know, we don't want to get too inside baseball here, and they're getting buzz. Explain the Lincoln Project, if you could, to my listeners.
So the Lincoln Project is just the latest manifestation of the Never Trump movement. So I go through this in my book, how they set up these little nonprofits. The Lincoln Project is the latest one. It's led by George Conway, Kellyanne Conway's husband. These people, there's nothing conservative or Republican about them, except he happens to be married to a conservative Republican. Steve Schmidt, the loser, failed campaign manager for John McCain, who, why would you have him do anything? Rick Wilson, who's covered in my book quite extensively. Kind of this group of loser Republican strategists and who knows what else they are. So they're fronted with money from the left. They create this Lincoln Project. They go then on cable news shows and regular news shows as representative, what you just said, fake collection of Republicans opposed to Trump. But the money mostly comes from the left. Now, I don't know specifically if the same money, the leftist funder who I talk about in my book, who's giving all this money to Bill Kristol's group and Evan McMullen's groups, the Bulwark, which is Charlie Sykes's offshoot of the Weekly Standard. So yeah. I go through how all of that is funded by the left. I suspect the Lincoln Project is too.
Do you think, I mean, what do you think, Julie, is the motivation here in the long run? I mean, I would have thought, or I would think that some Republicans would say, okay, we didn't support the president, but you know what? He won. And he's doing some of the things that we like. And although we kind of differ with him on the tweeting and, you know, how he comports himself, it's better to have an R in there or an R in there than a D. Do they not think that at all? Or do you think they're just, they don't want to admit it, but maybe in deep inside they've got to keep this facade up of being the loyal opposition? I'm wondering what their thinking is here.
That's a great question. I get asked a lot. So there's a couple motivating factors. One is just they just have a grudge against Donald Trump, but they don't want to admit that they were ever wrong. But when you look at the original National Review article that really started the Never Trump movement, a lot of those folks have come around and become big supporters of the president. Ben Domenech of the Federalist, Katie Pavlich, Dana Loesch, Brent Bozell, they all signed off on that issue. But as Trump governed as a conservative, and they saw what we were up against, this rampaging left, lunatic left, they've become strong supporters of the president. So one is the grudge. Two is this is careerism. It's the only way people, on what planet would anyone listen to a lunatic like Jennifer Rubin or Max Boot or, I mean, Rick Wilson, who just never has anything decent or intelligent to say. Right. So this is their shtick. And, you know, if they came around to Trump, no one would listen to them. So there's a few motivating factors, but a lot of it is just blatant careerism.
And, you know, Julie, a lot of people don't realize, and I try to tell them this all the time, not just for the left, but the right. It goes all around. A lot of the talking heads, as you pointed out a few moments ago, a lot of these talking heads have a monetary investment here in who gets elected on either side, because there are tie-ins to spouses or to consultancy, consultant work or contractual work. I mean, the roots of these people go very deep.
It really does. And this is the threat that Donald Trump and the new right poses to these establishment beltway types who've been there for decades and decades. So that is part of it. But look, Paul, the other thing is, and I've challenged a lot of these Never Trumpers. Okay, you're opposed to Trump. You don't like his tweets. You don't like his demeanor. But his policies are things that conservatives have talked about for decades. But if you don't like his quote-unquote trade war, okay, how do you want to approach this threat that China poses? They have no answers. Okay, you want to stay in Afghanistan and Iraq. How much longer do we have to stay there? What results have we gotten out of that? So when you push back a little, they have no answers themselves. It's just kind of this petulant, childish, ongoing temper tantrum that they keep having. And quite frankly, Paul, I think it's great if your friends on the left think that the Lincoln Project, you know, this is it. This is really going to take
Oh, my
down.
God.
Rick Wilson and George Conway, they're the slayers we've been waiting for. Like,
hey, you know
I
what,
love
Julie?
It is a head fake for them. Fine with me.
Oh, you know what? And it's funny because, I mean, you know, you mentioned them again. And come on, admit that you haven't. You can't admit that you and everybody you talk to haven't had the thought, like, really, like, what's the vibe there at night with, like, George Conway and Kellyanne Conway? I mean, I know that we all grew up with, you know, Mary Madeline and James Carville, so it can happen. But they were kind of a comedy act together. But, boy, George Conway, he's, with him and Kellyanne, what is up with that?
You know, I hate to talk about issues with other people's marriages, but now they've got their teenage daughter involved. I've got two teenage daughters, and it's playing out on social media. I don't know. I think it just makes everyone cringe, and it's such a bad deflection. But George Conway, shame on him. I mean, he has what? I think he has all daughters. To treat your wife that way in public and to be this way in front of your daughters you know, that's just you're creating a life of problems for your children.
I would bite my lip. If that was my wife, Julie, I would never say a peep in public. If I had issues with it, that's for when the girls are out of the house and we're alone and we discuss it. But no, you're right. It's not cool. Julie, hang on one more segment with you. Fascinating stuff. Name of the book is Disloyal Opposition: How the Never Trump Right Tried and Failed to Take Down the President. More with author columnist Julie Kelly coming up. First, let's check your ride. Traffic at 3:46 on WYZC. A couple of more minutes with author Julie Kelly, name of the book Disloyal Opposition: How the Never Trump Right Tried and Failed to Take Down the President, published by Encounter Books. Get it, order it wherever you get your books. You know, Julie, it's interesting. I wonder if the vitriol that some in the party show toward the president, this chattering class, and you and I both know that any president of either party is never going to be 100%. There's never going to be 100% support. There's going to be 5 or 10% who don't support him, but in the Republican camp, they seem to all be talking heads on TV. You know, Julie, I wonder if these are people who, as you said before, they understand that from a policy point of view, they kind of agree with this, but they just never had the guts to do it. You know, I tend to call them play nice Republicans. You talk a really good game, but when you have to get down and dirty like Democrats often do, and I give them credit for that, they circle the wagons. I think a lot of these talking heads and Never Trumpers, just for some reason, whether it's not having the guts or whatever, they just don't do it.
Paul, this is a gutless, aside from Donald Trump, a handful of House Republicans, a few governors, this is a gutless party. After Never Trumpers, I have been and continue to be highly critical of the Republican Senate, who has sat idly by as the biggest scandal in American political history has unfolded. They've done nothing to lift a finger to expose the perpetrators of the Russian collusion hoax, the Obamagate perpetrators. They've made threat after threat, and by this I mean people like Lindsey Graham and Chuck Grassley, who head up a powerful committee. They've called no open hearings. They've threatened to subpoena these people. They've subpoenaed a few. They've allowed them all to testify behind closed doors. Paul, just imagine for a minute if in 2017 and 18, instead of allowing the Mueller probe filled with partisan prosecutors to hunt down an imaginary crime, but in the meantime destroy the lives of innocent people with other made-up crimes or crimes that have never been prosecuted or rarely prosecuted, if instead Mitch McConnell, Chuck Grassley, Lindsey Graham, et cetera, would have held hearings exposing Jim Comey and Sally Yates and Andrew McCabe and Peter Strzok and Lisa Page and Glenn Simpson and Susan Rice, the entire list of people who put our country through hell for 2 years on something that they made up to conspire to take down this president. If they would have used their powers like the Democrats use their powers, we would be looking at a completely different political climate right now. Trump would be cruising through all of this. But instead, they signed off to that Mueller investigation, defended that investigation for 2 years with no oversight, while the American people were lied to that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia to influence the election. For that, I wish in an alternate universe the Republicans would lose the Senate, or they all would have been primaried and booted out by real conservatives, people who are willing to fight. This is such an abdication of power. It should outrage every Republican.
It's got to, Julie, be just kind of a self-preservation thing. Kind of, well, we don't want to really go there. You know, we'll talk a good game, but we don't want to get people angry. You know, Julie, my head was exploding during the 3 or 4 election cycles when you particularly heard from Republicans in the House, well, we're going to fix Obamacare. We're going to fix Obamacare. We're going to fix. Okay. Well, eventually, you're going to get the shot to do it. You better have something ready to go from day one, put together by the finest healthcare and economics people you have. And when that didn't happen, I said, well, this was all a charade. At least it was to me, Julie.
Well, it was. I mean, you know, you have John McCain, who was the biggest Never Trumper on Capitol Hill, powerful during the first 2 years of Trump's presidency. And of course, we know he gave the famous dramatic thumbs down on the repeal of Obamacare vote in the Senate. But, Paul, what has the Republican Senate done? Okay, they've approved some judges. They got through the Kavanaugh fight barely, even though they allowed that ridiculous trial to go on in front of Senate Judiciary with Kavanaugh and his accuser. So aside from that and tax cuts, what does the Republican Senate have to show for themselves for 4 years in power with a Republican president? Basically nothing.
What do you think happens in November, Julie? The president's in a pretty big hole now. You know, the polls don't look good. Is this over? Is he gonna take all the restraints off? What happens here? And what do you think happens if Joe Biden's elected?
I definitely don't think it's over. I think Trump was on the ropes, definitely. How could he not be? He's been through impeachment, coronavirus crisis, the economic meltdown, lockdown, and now racial war stoked by the left. So anybody would be on the ropes after that. I think he's finding his footing a little bit. But look, he has to fight back. His team needs to fight back. these Republican senators and Republicans and governors need to have his back. They need to continue to remind Americans the threat that the left poses as they've exposed themselves for what they are, which is a crusade to destroy our history, our present, and our future. He needs to make sure that our schools and businesses reopen as quickly as possible, get the economy going again, and he needs to get back to the Trump that he was, before this coronavirus crisis really kind of destabilized him.
Julie Kelly is the author. Name of the book, once again, Disloyal Opposition, How the Never Trump Right Tried and Failed to Take Down the President. Get it wherever you order your books, published by Encounter Books. Julie Kelly, thank you. It's been fascinating. We appreciate it. Good luck. And hopefully we can touch base in the future. Thanks, Julie. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
I appreciate it.
Thanks, Julie. So that's it, folks. Disloyal Opposition, How the Never Trump Right Tried and Failed to Take Down the President.
That brings us the bill today. Was the bipartisan attempt to come to some agreement and do a significant and strong bill. And I think that's what you see before you when you look at the draft that was released last night. Representative Stastrom, the other co-chair of the committee, will run through some of the elements of the bill, and each member of the co-chairs and ranking members will make some commentary.
Thank you to Senator Winfield, who has been such a champion and an advocate on this issue for any number of years. And also thank you to the ranking members of our committee, Senator Kissel and Representative Rabimbus. I don't think it's any secret that the four of us have been working together on a number of some of the most thorny issues that face our state that come before the Judiciary Committee together for a number of years now. And the bill you see before you, the draft that was released last night, is a product of those discussions and also the mutual respect and friendship of the group of the four of us. Although we may not always agree on every single issue, it is open and transparent dialogue between us that brings us to the product we were able to release last night and share with you all this morning. The bill is a robust one. It covers 60-some-odd pages in 40-something sections, all related to police accountability and transparency as we respond to this moment we're living in. We build upon some of the work that was done in 2015, in 2017, and again last year in Public Act 19-90 to expand on those efforts and keep Connecticut at the forefront of this issue. We make sure that our local police departments are working towards recruiting a diverse police force and require reporting of those efforts back to the state. We are going to require that state police officers be post-certified and get recertified under post. We're going to require that all police officers in the state have periodic mental health screenings to make sure those who are on our streets are mentally as well as physically fit to be doing so. We've increased training requirements to ensure the training is covering issues like implicit bias and how to manage crowds of people in crowd control situations. We're going to reconstitute the Post Council, which is the governing body which provides training and certification for police officers. We're going to sunset the current membership of that committee as of the end of this year and provide for new appointments come January that are more strictly tied to certain skill sets that we'd like to see on that committee, and also diversify the size towns that are represented on that council. We're going to make disciplinary records subject to the Freedom of Information Act. We're going to make sure that municipalities who want to have the ability to appoint citizen review boards and extend subpoena power to those review boards through their legislative bodies. We're going to request that local police departments look at their own efforts to engage more social workers to respond either in lieu of or in conjunction with police officers. We're going to require mandatory body and dashboard cameras for those officers who are engaging with the public. We're going to ban quotas for pedestrian stops. We're going to look at tightening up what type of military-grade equipment our local municipalities can buy through the federal 1033 program. We're going to ban consent searches of automobiles. And we're going to take another look at the use of force policy in Connecticut and make sure that we are applying an objectively reasonable standard to when police can use force, and also severely limit the instances in which chokeholds would be considered justifiable use of force. Chokeholds would only be justifiable if and when the officer's life is in imminent danger. We're going to require that officers have a duty to intervene when they observe excess use of force, and that they promptly report instances of excess use of force to their local police departments. And we're going to provide whistleblower and other protections to those officers who do report and intervene in excess use of force situations. Two of the most significant portions of this bill are: we're going to expand the ability of the Post Council to decertify a police officer and make sure that it's clear in statute that Post has the ability to remove or decertify a police officer when they've engaged in instances of excess use of force, or when they've engaged in conduct that undermines public confidence in law enforcement. And Post will have the ability to conduct hearings and make those determinations, and to remove an officer or to suspend or censure where they find that conduct by clear and convincing evidence. We're going to create an independent Office of the Inspector General. The Office of the Inspector General will, for administrative purposes only, be housed under the Division of Criminal Justice, but they will have the power and the authority to investigate police use of force cases and to prosecute those cases where necessary. They can also refer cases to Post for decertification of an officer. The Inspector General will be nominated by the Chief State's Attorney, but that person will have to be confirmed by the legislature after a hearing before the Judiciary Committee so that the public has an opportunity to weigh in and consult with their legislators on who that Inspector General should be. We're going to increase the penalties for making a false police report based on race, gender, national origin, or sexual identity. We're going to create a, the bill calls for creating a state cause of action to address civil rights violations. And the task force, and the bill also asks the task force that has been impaneled to continue to look into this issue as it moves forward in its deliberations and we move towards a general session in January, indicating that this is not necessarily the be-all and end-all bill on this issue, and that we still expect the task force to come forward with additional recommendations. Again, I want to thank Senator Winfield and the ranking members for their help and support. And at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Senator Kissel and Representative Rabimbus.
Good morning. I typically start off by saying it's an honor to be here, but this is not the case this morning. I am honored to be working alongside my colleagues on behalf of our respective caucuses on what I believe to be a very important proposed legislation. But what is not an honor are the circumstances that has brought us here today. Regarding the document that you have before you, this is a product of countless hours of speaking and negotiating with one another, and with many hours spent speaking to others in the community. There are sections in this document that some of us like. There are sections in this document that some of us do not like. And there are sections that we would like to see some changes made. What we essentially have agreed to is to let this document, as presented, be the subject of a hearing. We need to hear from those who will be directly and indirectly impacted by this proposal to come speak on it. We always need to make sure that what we do does not have unintended consequences. We also want to make sure that we always allow the ability for the public to participate whenever they want to. This is an important core function of our democracy. The exact format of the hearing we still do not know. That will be left up to our leaders to decide. We do intend to continue to listen and learn in order to make this proposal the best that we can. We also need to make sure that any mandates we place on our cities and towns through this proposal are actually funded. It is not enough to say it, but we must act on it. Otherwise, it is not worth the paper it is printed on. We cannot expect the best from our law enforcement if we cannot properly provide the necessary tools and resources to get the best out of them. This is just one piece of a larger puzzle. We as legislators need to continue to work together jointly with the community and our law enforcement officers on this proposal to make sure that we get it right. I look forward to hearing from everyone at the hearing and then getting back together again with my colleagues to work collaboratively in the hope of achieving a bipartisan proposal. I would like to take this opportunity to thank the chairs and my fellow ranking Senate ranking member for your joint commitment, dedication, and respect for the process during this entire process.
Good morning, everyone. Hope you can hear me. As you could probably tell, I haven't had the ability to schedule a haircut yet. That's in the hopeful near future. I want to thank the co-chairs, Representative Steve Stafstrom, Senator Gary Winfield, and my fellow ranking member, Representative Rosa Rabimbus, for working so tirelessly on this proposal. I don't want to be the one person up here that's going to throw cold water on this, but I just want to let everybody know so it's very clear, I have not personally endorsed this proposal. I'm still looking to hear from my constituents, folks in law enforcement, folks in other communities, and get as much human feedback as possible on this very long and very complex bill. Without a doubt, there are certain provisions in here that raise some concerns for myself. And after discussions with my colleagues in the Senate Republican Caucus yesterday afternoon, I think they're going to want to look at this bill extremely closely as well. So I can't predict if there will be votes from my caucus for this bill, one or none or several, at this point in time. This is the beginning of a process. I'm very honored to have been part of a process where we worked really, really hard to cobble together a slew of proposals to address the concerns that have been raised over the last not only just several months, although the voices have risen in the last several months, but these are issues that have been around for years. So it's exciting because I think as a state, we're starting from a position, as Representative Stafstrom said, that these are robust proposals. Where we end up, I don't know. It's my understanding that the legislative leadership will be meeting on Monday to discuss this bill and perhaps one other. Then, at least for our caucus, we're going to circle back sometime the middle of next week and discuss the bill after people have had a chance to really digest it. But along with my fellow ranking member, Representative Rabimbus, I think it's extraordinarily important to have some kind of hearing on this, whether it's written testimony and a combination of Zoom, whether it's actually some kind of social distancing within a physical building. I'm not quite sure how it'll unfold, but we do need, in my view, to have that information and feedback from all aspects of the public regarding these proposals. So I'm not a betting person. I'm not sure that everything in the bill will remain exactly as is, In fact, over the last several weeks, there's been a lot of iterations of this bill due to the really open and honest back and forth of the three people behind me and myself. And I really have to say I appreciate, given the fact that Senator Winfield and Representative Stafstrom have clear majorities in their chambers, that they were willing to listen to my concerns and Rose's concerns and make compromises along the way. So that tells me that there is a visceral desire to hopefully come together in some bipartisan fashion. But again, I can't predict where this is going to end. It's my understanding that there will be a desire to try to vote on this in some way, shape, or form, either separately or together before the end of this month of July. But I can't predict that that's exactly how things are going to unfold as well. I don't know if it was contemplated by the chairs, but I'm guessing that they're more than willing, and myself and Rosa, to answer any questions, but I can't speak for them. But that's why we're here this morning, and that's my statement regarding the proposal that we have before us. And again, I want to thank Chairman Stafstrom, Chairman Winfield, Ranking Member Rabimbus, for working so very tirelessly on this bill for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. Thank you all.
Section 30 of the bill right now proposes various changes to the deadly use of force standard. We have, in consultation, and I particularly want to thank the governor's office for weighing in, particularly with respect to this section of the bill, but seeks to go towards more of an objectively reasonable standard than we currently have in Connecticut law, which matches up more with the model penal code definition that is kind of the best practice throughout the nation. That objectively reasonable standard will look at whether the officer has exhausted reasonable alternatives, whether the officer reasonably believes the force creates no significant risk of injury to a third party, and reasonably believes that such use of force is necessary. So there are actual substantive changes to the use of force standard contemplated in this bill.
So explain what the use of force standard is currently.
Currently, it is more subjective than objective, and we're moving from a subjective standard to more of an objective standard.
Threat to the officer's life, threat to innocent bystanders. I thought that was sort of the standard.
Yeah. Well, that would still be in there. Certainly, if there is an objectively reasonable threat to the officer's life or to somebody else's life, they could still use deadly force. Absolutely.
Perhaps Senator Kissel and Representative Rabimbus could outline some of the provisions that they find problematic from a Republican perspective.
We'll certainly be happy to do that for you following the informational hearing and after we've had an opportunity to actually speak to our respective caucuses. Many of the members of our respective caucuses only received this language last evening along with everybody else. Certainly the concepts we've discussed, but the details we have not. Right now, as we stand up here, we've made the conscientious decision to put this proposal out the way it is. So at this time, there is no specifics, Republicans like this, Democrats like that, or we've had some discussions regarding all of the proposals, and we're certainly looking forward to the input, but we can't speak for our caucuses at this time.
Speak for yourselves, because each of you have gotten up and said there's parts of this bill that you said there's parts of this bill that are good, there's parts that we may not like, there may be parts that we're going to continue to work on. The senator expressly said he wasn't endorsing this bill. You're making clear that the only agreement right now is a bipartisan agreement to hold a hearing. So I'm just, what do you find problematic about certain provisions in this bill?
Certainly. And I appreciate the question. And I can only speak to the words that I said, and certainly Senator Kissel can address his words. But my words when I said that there are sections of this bill that we like, that we may not like, and that we want to see changes, that's based not only on our discussions, but most importantly on the discussions that we've had with respective individuals that this bill will be impacted, whether directly or indirectly. But now that we actually have the language down on paper, we need to give those same individuals the ability then to respond to the language as we were most often speaking on these as to the concepts of it. So I'm going to certainly, you know, reserve that right that at this time there's not been anything specifically identified back since the language has been put out, but I certainly look forward to having those conversations as we move forward.
About this bill that you don't that you find objectionable?
Now, right now, I'm going to focus on the process, and I hope that moving forward, what we learn from this is that when all sides come together and try to put out a product in the most dedicated, committed, respectful way, what we're attempting to do is achieve the best product. But now we do have a democracy put in place, and we have to hear from the public. That's the most important. So right now, we're standing by the document that's going out. We hope and invite input on it in order then to work collaboratively moving forward. I certainly expect that following the informational hearing, when we do hear from individuals and we go back to our respective caucuses, that we will be then able to work together, and the hope is to come out with a bipartisan proposal, which then means that at least the majority of both sides can endorse it. Or certainly, as Senator Kissel alluded, if there comes a time that that is not possible, then certainly I'm sure the differences will then be articulated.